Stand by, Jerry Saul Show. 5, roll tape. 4, cue Jerry. 3, bring audio up. 2, stand by. 1, play intro.
Stay tuned for the Terry Saul Show, Saltissimo, on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 and 1220 AM, KSLM.
Well, good morning, and welcome to the Terry Saul Show on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 FM, KSLM, and 1220 AM. I am your host, Terry Saul, and our guest today, I am really looking forward to this particular segment. His name is Larry Crompton. Did I get that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Larry was born in Canada in 1939, graduated high school in 1957, and then moved to the San Francisco Bay Area, where he joined the Contra Costa County Sheriff's Department in 1971. And you worked in detention, is that correct?
I worked in detention for a very short period of time.
Yeah, didn't like that?
Not really.
Yeah. And then you went on to patrol or into investigations?
No, I went into patrol.
How long were you with the sheriff's office?
I was there 28 years.
Why did you decide you wanted to be a cop?
Well, I was working a full-time job and a part-time job, and I saw an advertisement in the paper that said that the Contra Costa County Sheriff's Department was hiring deputies. And at the time, I didn't know what a deputy was, but I saw what they were making, and it was more than I was making in both of my jobs. So I applied for it and was very, very fortunate that I got hired.
Now, where is Contra Costa? I know where that's at because I lived in the same area there, but where is Contra Costa County for those listeners that don't know?
It's between Sacramento and San Francisco.
Okay, so that's quite a big area.
Oh, yes, yeah.
About how many square feet do you think Contra Costa County is?
I have no idea.
Yeah. What cities did it engulf?
Concord, Walnut Creek, and you got Pleasant Hill. You got different areas around there, but yeah. Concord was the biggest one.
Yeah. Do you know what the traffic's like in that area now?
I know what it was like back then. It was horrible, and the last time I was down there, it's worse.
All right. So you started in 1971, and when did you wrap it up?
I got out in 1998.
Yeah.
And
how did you end up here in Oregon?
Well, our son and our daughter moved up here. Our son moved up here. He started out with us with the Contra Costa County Sheriff's Department and decided to come up here. So he got hired by Eugene Police Department.
Oh, nice.
And then our daughter moved up here, and they said that I had to promise that when I retired, I'd move to Oregon.
Yeah.
And it worked out fine.
And you haven't looked back, right?
No, yeah. Not at all.
It's God's country up here. I tell people that all the time. Well, Larry, you're here for a reason. You wrote a book. The book is called Sudden Terror, and it's a true story. There's so much to cover in here. I hope that we can do it all here, 1 hour that we have here. But there was some incidents that happened in the 1970s and the 1980s. Now, I remember this because I lived in San Jose during that time frame. What happened?
I didn't even know about it at the time, but in 1976, this person started raping in Sacramento. He was very, 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 very bad and one of the worst. We did not know anything about it, even though we didn't, we weren't far from Sacramento.
When you say bad, one of the worst, without getting too graphic, what does that mean?
He wanted to terrorize.
Okay.
And in reading the reports, we knew that he wanted to kill right from the very start. And he put that into the minds of the victims and would threaten over and over and over. And when he first started, it was just women, and he would break in. But the sex was not the thing with him. The terror that he put in their minds was what it was. And right from the very start, he would tell them he was going to kill them and wanted to kill them. And they knew that. And a lot of them.
Did he kill them?
He didn't start out that way, no.
Okay, okay.
But when I finally got involved in it, I was working in the crime lab. And they had transferred me there to work with the ones there. And we'd go out and do the scenes.
So You said that this happened in the Sacramento area?
Yes.
Okay. And you were in Contra Costa County Why is it that if these were so bad, why is it you guys didn't know anything about this?
Back in those days, if you didn't live in the town where it was going on or get the newspaper, you didn't know about it. It just was not passed over into other areas. Even though during that time, he hit in Davis, which was only
Sacramento.
Miles from us.
Yes.
We had not heard of it at all. When we got the call that Sacramento wanted to come down and meet with us and talk to us and tell us that this rapist that they called the East Area Rapist was coming, they felt was coming to our area.
Now, so at this point, it has not happened in your jurisdiction. Is that correct?
That is correct. No, he had not come down to our area at all at that time.
Okay. What did they know about him? Did they know anything at all about this guy?
All they knew about him is what he did at every one of his attacks. And he knew that he would tie the people up. He would threaten them over and over and over. And once he started hitting places where there was a man in the house, he would put dishes on the man's back.
What?
And tell the man, if I hear these rattle, I'll kill your wife. I'll kill you. I'll cut off the ears of your children and bring them to you.
Okay, so Larry, he would break into these houses knowing, I mean, did he know the victims?
We know that he prowled, and he knew what house he was going to hit. And
really?
He knew what was going to happen. And at times, what we found is that he would go into the house when the people weren't there and set it up by unlocking windows or unlocking a certain door and leaving his shoelaces hidden somewhere so that he would have them there to tie them up when he did come in. Other times, he would wait in the backyard until they went to bed, went to sleep, turned out the lights, and then he would break in. And
he was staking out the particular house. It wasn't random then. He knew where he was going.
Oh, he knew what house he was going
to. How did he choose the particular victim? Was it just anybody on the street that he happened to see? Was it somebody that he was in contact with? How did he know who he was going after?
We don't really know for sure on that, but we know that he prowled areas and picked out where he was going to go, even though a couple of times he hit a place that he did not plan on hitting because of something that come up at that time. But other than that, we knew that the house he went to is the one that he was waiting for and the one that he was going to hit, and he knew who was going to be there. There was a couple where, like I said, the people weren't even at home while he set it up. He waited for them to get home and waited in the backyard.
He would be stalking the property then, or checking the property out, I guess you would say. So would he get there that day, or would it be a couple of days in advance? Or, I mean, how nobody saw this guy snooping around someone's backyard?
He was seen, I feel, many times. But back then, again, people didn't get involved. And there were times when he was in the area and people would see somebody that didn't look like they should be there or didn't recognize the car that was driving around. Back then, it wasn't the same as what it is today. And
okay.
So they weren't calling it in and they weren't doing anything about it.
This guy would basically, we're talking about 100 to 150 different places that he ransacked during that particular time, is that correct?
No. What happened was down in Visalia, prior to the rapes.
Visalia is further south?
Southern California.
Okay.
Yes. What we find out now is that he was a burglar, and he did probably over 100 burglaries at that time down in that area. But then when he moved to Sacramento, that's when he started the rapes. And
really?
When he first started, it was just women alone in the house. And what most people don't realize is that on his first 10 attacks, 6 of them were teenagers. 2 of them were 15 years old.
Oh, really?
And in all of his rapes, he hit 2 that were 13 years old. And it was just unbelievable that he would be doing things like that. But when he started, like I said, it was women. But then in the newspaper, in the Sacramento newspaper, it said that there had never been a man in the house.
His that changed.
Next attack, there was a man in the house.
And he knew that?
And yes, he definitely knew.
How was it that he was never overpowered? If he's going in there, and there's a guy in the house, I mean, would he pick particular victims that he knew he could overpower himself?
No, he had a plan that he stayed with. And he would use a gun if there was a man in the house.
Okay.
And he would put that gun at the man's head. But what, like I said, he would wait until they were asleep. Then he would come into the room, into the bedroom, with a flashlight or whatever, knock on the side of the bedroom door and wake them up.
What?
He always had a mask, always had a mask, always wore gloves. He would shine that light in the man's eyes, and he would tell them, don't move. Don't move. If you do, I will kill you. And at times, he would put that gun to the man's head and cock it. But then he would put the shoelaces on the bed next to the woman, and he would tell the woman, tie your husband's hands behind his back. Tie them tight, tight. And she
what?
Would tie his wrists. And then he would retie that man real tight to where he would lose all feeling in his fingers. And then he'd tie his ankles the same way. Then he would tie the woman, tie her hands behind her back the same way, very, very tight. And then he would tie her ankles not tight. And then he would tell them, I don't want you to move. Don't do anything. I will kill you. And he would put the dishes on the man's back and tell him, if I hear these, I will kill you, I will do this, I will do that. Then he would rummage through the house. And then he would come back and say, all I want is money. All I want is money. I need gas for my car, and I'm hungry. And then he would rummage some more. And then he would come back and he'd say, okay, I can't find your money or whatever. And then he'd tell the woman, you get off the bed. And he would untie her feet just by pulling on the lace. He would have it that loose. And then he would get her off and take her into another room and put her on the floor and tell her, don't move, stay here. And then he would go back in and tell the man, if I hear these dishes rattle, I will kill your wife. I will kill you. And if there was a child in the house, he'd tell him, I'd cut the child's ears off and bring them to you. So he would put that fear in them, and then he would go back to the woman, and that's when he would continue with the rape.
So how long would he be in somebody's house? In order to do everything that you just said, he's going to be in there a while.
Sometimes he was there 3 to 4 hours.
Serious?
Oh, yes. And like I said, he would do it at night. Wait until they were asleep and then wake them up. A few times he did it prior to that, but 90% of the time he waited until they were asleep, and he would wait in the backyard and then he would come in.
Now, when you said earlier that he was known to have raped young women, 13, 14 years old, how would he do that in the house without their parents hearing or somebody hearing that?
Just the way that he did. He would tell the kids, you got to be quiet. If you say anything, I'll kill you. He was just that way. Now, a couple of times, the 17-year-old that he hit, she was in the house alone, no parents, because she was babysitting.
Right.
But she was babysitting for some kids, and those kids were in their bedroom asleep, and he never woke them up. And it was all just what he was doing. So he knew what he was doing. And a couple of times, one child woke up and came into the room, and he took that child, put the child in the bathroom, and told him to shut up, and put a chair in front of the bathroom door so the kid couldn't get out, and then he continued with his thing.
But he never hurt the child, though?
No, never hurt the child, except the 13s and the 15-year-olds.
Right, and those he raped?
Those he raped.
Unbelievable. Larry Crompton is our guest. We're going to take a break. Don't go anywhere because we've got a lot more to cover. You're listening to The Terry Saul Show on 104.3 FM, KSLM, and 1220 AM. Back in just a moment. Hang on, folks. This is going to get real interesting.
You're listening to The Terry Soul Show, Saltissimo, on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 and 1220 AM KSLM.
Listening to The Terry Soul Show on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 FM and 1220 AM, KSLM.
Welcome back to The Terry Soul Weekend Show. Today's guest is Larry Crompton. I'm sorry. He is a retired Contra Costa County deputy. He was with them back in the 70s. We were talking about this dirtbag is probably the easiest way to call him. That did a lot of rapes down in the Bay Area at that time. He was called the East Area Rapist. He was called the Original Night Stalker. He was called the Golden State Killer. And, Larry, you were telling me off the air here that back in 1976, when he was doing his horrendous crimes there, it was close to you in Sacramento, but you guys didn't know about this until finally, what, you got a phone call one day from Sacramento?
What happened was the sheriff contacted us. I was in the crime lab at the time and said that Sacramento wanted to come down and talk to some of the agencies down there about a rapist that they had up in the Sacramento area.
Now, you guys had not heard anything about this guy, right?
We had not heard a thing about him.
No. Okay, okay.
So Sergeant Bevins and Lieutenant Root come down, and we met.
Why would they contact you? Why would they contact your agency?
Well, we were the sheriff's department, which is the biggest agency there.
Okay.
But also they had Concord, Pleasant Hill, Walnut Creek, Antioch, and Pittsburgh.
Okay.
Also at that meeting. They come down and told us that they had been hit 37 times.
What?
In Sacramento and in the Sacramento area and other areas around there, and told us about this person and said that we believe he is coming to your area. And we didn't know why that they felt that way, but in reading the reports later, we found out that he had mentioned a few times that he was going to move to Los Angeles. So
he had mentioned to who?
Just to the victims. And
what would he say? I'm
said that
I'm leaving tomorrow to go to L.A.
No, he just said that that's where he was going to head for. He needed money. He needed gas for his van. Remarks like that. They just had that feeling that he was heading in our area. He had hit Davis twice, and Davis was not far from Contra Costa.
Davis is a college town, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Okay.
And he had hit there, and we had not heard about that either. So when they talked to us, said, you had better work together. You need a task force. We have a task force up in Sacramento, and you need this because he is that violent. You have got to do it. So we thought, oh, this is Contra Costa County. We don't have serial rapists like that, and we have burglars and things like that, but that's it. But then he did hit Concord just 2 months later.
How did you know it was the same man? Because of the same MO that he was using? And
well, once he hit Concord and we found out about it at the lab, then Bevins was contacted and was told about the attack. So, again, they come down and talk to us again and said, yes, this is our East Area Rapist. And he was called the East Area Rapist because that's where he started hitting, with East Area of Sacramento. So they just named him the East Area Rapist. So they told us, yes, that is him, and he's going to continue hitting down here.
How often was he hitting?
Well, at times he would hit once a week. At times he would wait a couple of weeks, find the one that he wanted to hit and where it was. Had to work it out and do it that way. It was difficult to know where he was going to hit. But like I said, he hit Concord, then he hit Concord again. We knew that, yes, he was in our area. And then we had to be had to be on top of things.
And so, there was no traces, Larry. He didn't leave anything behind that you guys could see. No fingerprints, because he wore gloves, you said. He wore a mask. This guy did his homework, didn't he?
Yes, he did. The only thing that we found were shoe prints. And because I worked in the lab, it was my job to process scenes. And I would do the shoe prints and get those. And we would check for fingerprints. But like I said, he was never seen without gloves, always wore gloves. He always wore the mask.
Was he ever seen, Larry? Did anybody ever see him leaving a site that was, the scene of a crime?
Not that they could really determine who it was, no. What he would do, like I said, he would tie them up very, very tight. And a lot of times he would cut the cord to the phones, but he made sure that where he parked his car was close enough to where he could get to his car with them being tied before they could contact the police or anybody else. And that would give him that much time. So he knew what was going on. At times he would steal a bicycle and ride that bicycle from his car to where he did the rape and then back to his car. And we knew that because we would have the dogs come. We had very, very good team that would come, and their dog would follow the scent. And we knew where he had parked his car and all that.
So how many people were on this task force looking for this guy?
It depended. With us, we had seven of us that worked continually with it. But again, we didn't have the task force put together until December of 78.
And how many rapes did he have done by then?
By then, he had done 42, I believe it was. But like I said, he did 37 in Sacramento.
Okay.
Before we even knew about it. So when he come down, he hit Concord twice, the first two times. And then he hit our area in Danville.
How pissed off were you?
Very.
How mad were you? You wanted to catch this SOB.
Oh, yes. And then when I got the reports from Sacramento on all the previous rapes and went through those, and we saw what kind of a person he was, it was very bad. When you see teenagers that had to go through this.
Sure.
It's bad for adults to go through it, but knowing that a teenager went through that and hadn't even had a boyfriend before and had that for the rest of their life was horrible.
Larry, we need to take a short break. When we come back, more with today's guest, Larry Crompton, who is a retired Contra Costa County investigator. His book is called Sudden Terror, and we're going to talk some more about this incredible, incredible experience. We'll be back in just a moment here.
You're listening to The Terry Soul Show, Saltissimo, on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 and 1220 AM KSLM.
We are back. This is the Terry Saul Weekend Show, Salem's original radio station, KSLM AM and FM. I am your host. Today we are talking with Larry Crompton, who's got a book out called Sudden Terror. The book is all about the East Area Rapist, the original Night Stalker, the Golden State Killer from the San Francisco Bay Area. Larry is a former, I should say, Contra Costa County Sheriff's Deputy. He was a big part of this whole era, I guess you would say. We're talking about some of the rapes. Did you ever interview any of the victims?
Oh, yes.
How tough was that?
Very tough. In talking to them and finding out what was on their mind and what they went through. And there was one lady that she couldn't even go back into the house.
Really?
It was that bad. She knew that she was going to die. And in talking to the victims, I tried to explain to them that the man felt that he was there, was supposed to protect his wife or his girlfriend.
Sure.
And I tried to get it into their head that if you'd both be dead. And I know it's hard to live with this, but that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to kill. And we knew that that was going to happen.
How did you know he was going to kill?
In reading the reports and knowing what he said to all of them. And then I met with a doctor at the Vacaville Medical Center where they have prisoners, rapists that are prisoners.
Okay.
And I gave her three of my reports, asked her to go over them, and then she asked me to come back the following week. And she said, I'd talk to my rapist, and we'll get together. So I went back, and she said, you better catch him. Said, he wants to kill. He's going to kill. And I said, yeah, I felt that. And she said, yes. She said, my rapist said that you had better catch him. He's giving them a bad name. And I said, giving them a bad name.
What?
And she said, well, you have to understand who I deal with here. They don't think they hurt anybody. They're rapists, and they're doing it for sex. This fella is not doing it for sex. And we knew that. He's doing it for terror, because a lot of the victims said that he was never fully erected, and they would hear him lubricating himself before he would do it.
Okay.
And he would have to go through other things.
Right.
So it was not that. It was the terror that he was putting in them. When I had to talk to the 17-year-old that was hit in Walnut Creek, she was babysitting. To talk to her and to see what she went through, and knowing that that was going to be with her the rest of her life. And then I went to Walnut Creek, the police department, and talked to them and told them, this isn't who he was after. He's going to hit you again. I knew that this was not who he was after, because she was babysitting at that house and had not babysat there for 2 months.
So he got the wrong person.
She was sitting at the table doing her homework, had the door open. The screen door was closed, but the main door was open. And he was on his way to the place where he was going to hit when he saw her and saw, oh, here it is. So he did. Then, later, he hit Walnut Creek again, and he hit the one that he was after. She was 13 years old. And I had the opportunity to talk to her. She had never even had a boyfriend before, knew nothing about anything like this. And it took him a while so that he could even rape her, because of the fact that she was that young. And the fear that he put in her mind and everything that she went through. In talking to victims like that, you can't get it out of your mind.
No,
you know, no. I have a job to do, and my job is to stop him.
And at this point, you had no idea who it was. Did you have any suspects?
Oh, many, many, many suspects.
But nobody
People were calling all the time and giving us names, and we would go through and eliminate them. I felt that...
Was he ever a suspect?
No, his name was never brought up.
And we're gonna mention who he was a little bit later on, but not yet. Larry, he eventually killed people.
Yes,
what happened? The raping was not enough for him? He now needed to kill?
Like the doctor said, he wanted to. And I said, why hasn't he? And she said, he hasn't found the justification yet. And I said, okay. Well, the justification was the attack in my area, the last attack. The people got away. And what happened was the man woke up while the rapist was pulling his ski mask onto his head. So he didn't have a gun in his hand. He just had his hands on the ski mask.
Okay.
And this man yelled, screamed at him and got his attention. And they had known about the rapes, so they had made an escape route if they were ever attacked.
Really?
So while he was yelling at this man, his wife was able to follow that path and get away. And then once he realized that his wife was free, then he also got away. And he was big enough where he could have picked this rapist up and thrown him out the window. All he could think about was, my wife is free, I'm going to go. Then the rapist got away and just walked away. That was the first time that anybody did that. So
now he felt the need, he had to kill him.
Well, the next attack that we didn't even know about was down in Santa Barbara.
Okay.
And what happened was Jim Bevins, the sergeant with Sacramento, and I were working very close together. And he heard of a double homicide down in Santa Barbara. And he called Santa Barbara, and they said, we don't know what you're talking about. Haven't had it. So he ran it by me, so I contacted Santa Barbara, and I got the same thing. No, don't know what you're talking about. We haven't had anything like that. So the following month, I was sent to a class down in San Diego. The sheriff sent me down. And there was a Santa Barbara deputy in the class, and I got talking to him. And he said, oh, yeah, we had the double homicide. He said, a matter of fact, just before that, he said, we had an attempted rape where the people got away.
What was the big secret? Why did Santa Barbara not want you to know?
I asked this deputy that, and he said, well, understand. He said, President Reagan has a ranch down here. They don't want the publicity.
Oh, come on.
So that's the way things were back then. It made it very, very difficult. Agencies didn't always get along. Agency didn't always pass on information. And I was very, very fortunate to work with Sergeant Bevins with the Sacramento. He and I got along. And anything that we heard, we passed it back and forth. And we went to cases together and that.
He's now down in Santa Barbara area. So what are you guys thinking at this point? Are you thinking, well, he's down there, he's their problem?
We weren't thinking that. But unfortunately, agencies were thinking that.
Really?
And Sergeant Bevins and I went over the reports, and we said, this murderer is our rapist. But nobody would listen to us. Nobody would believe us. And we were told, he's left our area. It's not our problem anymore.
Leave it alone. Let them deal with it.
We couldn't. Could not leave it alone.
Good for you.
But there was nothing we could do other than stay with it. And we still worked on names that we thought might be the one and worked on them to eliminate. I got about 7,000 names of parolees that were paroled for a six-month period prior to the first rape in Sacramento, because I thought, this can't be somebody who just started raping. He must have known and learned from it. And so I thought, maybe that. Eliminated all the way down to 41 parolees that I couldn't eliminate and never did, could never contact him. And fortunately, he was not one of them.
So how many murders did he commit?
Two that we thought about in Sacramento but couldn't prove at the time.
Okay.
And then 10 in Southern California, and then one more in Southern California that we were able to get involved with.
And this was all during the years of 1976 to 79?
No, that was 76. His last murder that we knew of was a teenager.
Okay.
In 1986, Janelle Cruz.
Recently, or more recent, I should say.
No, that was 1986.
Okay.
And that was the last attack that we know of.
Rape or murder?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And that's one of the things that they're working on now to see if they could put something together, because, like I said, there's no way he could have quit. Once he started murdering, the murder was what he wanted to do. So it stayed in his mind. So he didn't have to do that every week.
Okay.
You could wait in between. What was he doing in that 4 years between the last two murders? We don't know.
Do you think he was still down in Southern California, or did he work his way back up, or was he just there?
No, he worked his way back up to Sacramento.
Okay.
And that's where he's been living when they arrested him. That's
okay, we'll get into that in our next segment here. There. So what was the total that he did 13 murders and well over 50 home invasion rapes?
Yes.
Is that what it was?
Yes, yeah.
Amazing.
And unfortunately, the statute of limitations ran out on the rapes, of course, by the time that that we got involved in this.
Right.
But some of them they're going to be able to charge, because kidnapping, that statute had not run out, and some of them he did take out of the house.
Who was the youngest that he murdered? What was the age of the youngest that you know of that he murdered?
She was 19. That was Janelle Cruz.
Yeah.
And just horrible to think of what she went through.
Without getting too graphic, how would he murder him? Shoot him, or was it more torture?
When he first started, the Robert Offerman and Deborah Manning, Jim Bevins and I heard about, he shot them, murdered them. And my feeling is that he learned from that makes a lot of noise. From then, he beat them to death.
Really?
Yes, just beat them.
Our guest today is Larry Crompton, who is a retired Contra Costa County Sheriff's Deputy. And we're going to talk about this guy. He was recently captured after all these years. And we're going to chat about that in just a moment. Don't go away. Taking a quick break. We're just getting warmed up here. You're listening to the Terry Saul Show on 104.3 FM and 1220 AM. We are KSLM. Back in just a moment.
You're listening to The Terry Soul Show, Saltissimo, on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 and 1220 AM, KSLM.
Hi, this is Terry Soul, Saltissimo.
And this is Doc Nelson.
Hey, you know, I am on, Doc, every Saturday at 10 o'clock right here on KSLM. Do you ever listen?
Oh, all the time. I also know you're on Sundays and a repeat broadcast.
That's right. Sundays at 11 o'clock, you can hear me, and you never know who my guests are going to be.
They're like, always special.
Maybe even Doc Nelson.
I've been there.
There you go. So join us right here on Salem's original radio station, 104.3 FM, KSLM, and 1220 AM. We're done, Doc.
Now?
Right now.
Back in 5, 4, Q-Terry, 2, 1, you're on.
We are back with our final few minutes. Our guest today is Larry Crompton, who, again, is a retired Contra Costa County Sheriff's Deputy. We're talking about these murders and rapes ravaged the San Francisco Bay Area and Southern California during the 1970s and the 80s. Larry, you guys caught the guy. It took a while, but you caught him. How'd that happen?
What happened was, like I said, I knew about the murders, and I felt it was the same person. I retired in 98, and in 2000, Paul Holes, a criminalist from Contra Costa, called me and said that he heard that I was on the East Area Rapist Task Force. And he said, if you can give me some names, he said, I'm a DNA expert. I will do the DNA on it.
But you already retired.
I was retired, but I never
got
out of it.
You weren't going to let it go, were you?
Oh, no.
Good for you.
I had to stay with it.
Good for you.
I gave him the names, and Paul called me back about 4 months later and said that he had joined them, and yes, it was the same. And I said, Paul, I know of 5 homicides in Southern California, and I said, nobody will believe me. It's the same person. If you can get a criminalist down there that will cooperate with you, I know that it's the same person. And at that time, like I said, we didn't know about DNA back when this was happening. Down in Southern California, they had already done DNA on their homicides, but we knew nothing about anything like that. So Paul Holes called me back 7 months later, and he said, no, they didn't have 5 homicides. Said they had 10. We just joined 6 of them.
Wow.
And so Orange County flew me down to talk to their task force down there because they were working on the homicides. And I had all the reports of Northern California. So I took those down with me for them to look at because they did not know who they were looking for. And now in looking at these reports, they knew what kind of a person it was and gave them a better idea of what to do. I started working with Larry Poole, the sergeant with Orange County. And anything that I heard, I made sure he heard about, and he stayed in contact with me. So we still stay in contact today, anything that goes on. And it was the DNA that finally solved this case.
Okay. The DNA comes back. You've got an idea at that point. How did the DNA narrow it down to how many?
At that point, the DNA said that they had 6 homicides that was connected.
Okay.
And those homicides were connected to our DNA on the rapes.
But how did you determine who it was? How did that come about?
At that time, we didn't know who this was. But what happened was years later, they kept working on this. And then because of the genial DNA where a relative had turned in her DNA just to check her history and her relatives.
What?
And this joined to the DNA that we had in the system.
Okay.
And they worked that down to about 2 people that looked good.
Oh, my gosh.
And one of those they eliminated. And then the one that was finally arrested.
Yeah.
And we know now Joseph James DeAngelo. He, at that time when they arrested him, he was 72 years old.
He was just recently arrested.
He was arrested on April the 24th of this year.
Of this year?
Yes.
Just a couple of months ago?
Yes.
So after 50 years, they got their man?
Yes.
And he's alive, obviously.
He's alive.
What do we know about him?
We don't know much about him because he's not talking. But what they did, they followed him that week, and they got DNA off the door handle on his car.
Okay.
And then they also got DNA off a piece of paper that he had thrown away.
Okay.
And joined it, and then they knew for sure that it was him. So they waited until he came out of his house, and they arrested him. And
what did he say?
He said, "I've got a roast in the oven. I've got a roast in the oven."
Seriously?
Yes. And in my mind, he wanted to get back in the house. The reason he wanted to get back in the house is he didn't have his gun. And I was told by psychiatrist and I was told by the doctor at the Vacaville Medical Center, he will kill. He will kill you. And if that doesn't work, he'll kill himself. But he will not be taken.
They wheeled him in for his court appearance. He was in a wheelchair.
He was in a wheelchair.
What happened to him?
Laying off to the side, couldn't talk.
Yeah.
Well, once he found out that they had videotaped him that whole week, and they videotaped him doing 100 miles an hour on his motorcycle, and then you check his yard and you see what kind of work he did around his yard, from then on, he didn't have to act that way in court.
He thought this whole thing out, didn't he?
Oh, yes.
Do we know what he did for a living?
Yes, unfortunately, we do. He was a police officer for 3 years down in Southern California. He was with the Exeter Police Department.
Auburn?
Who was
with Auburn?
That was him. He left Southern California, moved to Northern California, where he was hired by the Auburn Police Department, and he worked for them for 3 years. And that's where he was working when he started the rapes in Sacramento. They hired him in 1976. He was fired in 1979 for shoplifting.
Are you serious? Yes. For shoplifting?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
My gosh.
And one of the things that he shoplifted was dog repellent. And that was one thing that we learned over the rapes. Even when there was a dog there, the dogs never bothered him.
Why does this seem like, and I don't mean to make light of it, but why does it seem like it should be an episode on Criminal Minds? I mean, this is bizarre.
Oh,
he
yes.
was a police officer, which probably explains why he thought this out thoroughly before he would commit these crimes.
Yes, and it gave him the opportunity to know what area he was going to go to. He would learn that area. Just by
did he ever
around.
Did he ever commit any of these crimes while on duty?
Not that we could say, no.
Yeah. Does he have a family?
He was married at the time, but separated, and he did have daughters.
No,
and the families in the area where he lived said that that he raised those girls and was very vocal and would be screaming and yelling at them at times. And other times they'd hear him screaming and yelling in the backyard, and they would look over the fence. He'd be back there by himself, just yelling.
Have you had a chance to, I don't want to say meet him, but have you had a chance to interview him at all or anything?
Oh, no.
Would you want to?
Yes, I would.
What would you ask him?
What I'd like to know is, number one, what did I miss? And I'd like to know how close we came to him,
yeah.
or how close anybody came to him. But I'd like to get into his mind as to why he had that in his mind, the terror that he had to put in others' minds. Why was that there?
Yeah.
And how did he deal with it?
Well, it's amazing. That was one of those things you just couldn't let go. Do you think about it often?
Oh, yes. During all those years, I could not sleep at night.
Sure,
I would wake up in the middle of the night wondering what I did wrong. And then it finally dawned on me, it wasn't about me, it's about the victims.
Yeah.
They needed the closure.
You have a book out called Sudden Terror. It's all about it. And you say, don't read this at night. Don't read this tonight. How do people get a hold of this book if they wanted to read up more on this thing?
Well, I had it self-published through Author House. I just wanted it out there so that people could read it and maybe come up with a name. And you can also get it on Amazon.
Uh-huh.
And I, like I said, didn't do it to make money. I get 95 cents if a book sells. But that's not what it was about. It was about getting it out there so somebody could say, I know somebody that lived in those areas, was in those areas when this was happening.
How did you find out that he was captured?
I got a call from Richard Shelby, and he was a retired deputy that had worked on the Sacramento Task Force, and said, there's a rumor. Did you hear that that they have arrested somebody? And I said, no. So I called Larry Poole, the one down in Orange County that I had worked with, the sergeant down there, and I said, did you hear this? And he said, no, but let me check. 15 minutes later, he called me back and said, yep, he was arrested. He's in jail.
That's a wrap. Good job, folks. And we're off. Thanks, everybody.
Bye, everybody.